Hello, and welcome to the Cinemondo Podcast with Kathy, Mark, and Burke, talking about movies. Horror, sci-fi, unusual, unknown, forgotten, underappreciated, always interesting. We have a special guest today, Kathy.
Yay, Micah Gallo, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
He is the director of the new film that you can find streaming called Itsy Bitsy.
It's also on Blu-ray and DVD, and we've talked about it a few different times on different podcasts.
So fun.
So we're very happy to have you on because we were big fans of this movie for a lot of reasons, which we'll get into. So thanks for taking some time out to chat with us.
Oh, I appreciate it. Excited to talk with you guys.
Yeah, so how did you, we'll just start from the beginning. How did you get involved, into film and, wanted to become a filmmaker? How did that germinate?
You know, I'm sure it's a pretty common story, but in my hometown where I grew up, which is Merced, it was the thing to do on weekends. Everybody went to the movies, and we watched a lot of movies, and then with VHS and TV, I was also watching a lot of movies all the time. It was just kind of something that was central to our family. And I was always fascinated by them. I began to become interested in how movies were made. And my dad had an old school camcorder that he used to videotape our soccer games and stuff like that. So we started making movies, and I started kind of taking control of that process.
directing the soccer
movies.
Yeah, I was
directing my siblings, like, no, wrong. Like,
let's this. Try that again.
You didn't like your dad's edit, so you said, I'm going to come in there and fix it up.
Yeah.
And fix it up in post. Yeah.
Dad, I'm sorry. We're going to have to replace you.
So that's kind of how it began. And then I was always interested in the process, but it just seemed like something that wasn't possible for me. I didn't know any filmmakers. I didn't know how that worked. And so it wasn't until high school when I took they had one of the New York Film Academy programs that was actually at UCLA. And I did that, and we shot on 16 millimeter. I think it was one of the last times that they actually were still shooting on film and you were editing on film, you know, like on an old Steenback or something.
Right.
And so it was a good introduction to that process for me.
And yeah, that's a great experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I did. And then when I went to college, I went to USC, but I didn't get into the film school as a freshman, but I took the film classes and figured out who was on the board and who was making decisions on who got into the film school. And I found a way to get letters of recommendation that from some of those teachers that helped me get in there. And from there, just kind of kept working at it. You know, I worked on a lot of indie movies, usually for not a lot of money or sometimes for free. And I was either a PA, or then I got into camera assisting, and I was also an AD for a while. And from there, I made my first kind of more serious effort for a short film that was based on a feature script I wrote. And I got introduced to Tyler Hawes, who worked with me on Itsy Bitsy. Mm-hmm. And he at the time was working by himself out of an office in Santa Monica. And he had already done post-production on a pretty good amount of films. And he asked me, he said, hey, do you know any producers who could help me who would want to grow this business with me? And I said, yeah, sure. And I gave him a list, and he said, no, I mean, you, would you want to help me work on this? And I said, not really. But then he talked to me about it more and kind of convinced me that it was somehow going to help us with our filmmaking career dreams. And so that was Lit Post, which we built that business and worked on over 40 feature films, mostly indie genre stuff, doing color correction and visual effects and mastering and online editing. And
that's great.
Then, yeah,
so
I
you
sold
have
out
a,
of that business.
A well-rounded idea of how films get made. I think that's so important for a director, a creative person in film, to have experience in different departments.
Yeah. It was useful for me. And, you know, even though I have a lot of post-production experience, at least in managing that process. My favorite part of the process is still being on set.
Mm.
So I'd love to get more gigs in the future that are maybe even TV gigs or where I'm a director for hire, because my favorite place to be is on set. I just feel very comfortable on set. And some of the other processes like writing and pre-production and post-production, just they're a little long for my attention span. You know, yeah. I like the immediacy of being on set and that things are happening.
Yeah, right, the writing and post-production, the outer edges of production like that are so isolated. You're just, it's you sitting yeah. by yourself in your, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And mm-hmm. the on set is so vital, so full of energy. You're surrounded by all these creative people and there's ideas flying around, and that's the fun place to be for sure.
That's how I feel. Yeah, that's how I feel. There's other filmmakers who I guess feel the opposite. You know, I've heard George Lucas say things like, oh, he prefers post-production, or some filmmakers like the kind of peace and quiet and the ability to focus. Yeah. But I like the energy.
He might not be a people person. Right. That's my guess. Yeah. You know,
exactly.
Kind of get that impression.
Probably true.
I kind of enjoy both. You know, it's interesting. There's it's like two completely different worlds of production. It's fun to be on the set, but like you were saying, I get a little overwhelmed sometimes when I worked on set. And I work in a realm that's kind of a weird hybrid of post production and production, but I'm by myself and I'm fine with that too.
Uh-huh.
So you decided, hey, I'm going to make a feature, and did a Kickstarter. Is that how originally Itsy Bitsy got funded?
No, basically what happened was I sold out of my post-production business. And so my partner was working with a new partner. They since like separated, and now Tyler has a different business. He's making commercials and posting his own commercials that he co-directs. And so he's also transitioned. But at the time, I took that money, which wasn't a large sum, and then basically put it all into pre-production of Itsy Bitsy. So wow. Itsy Bitsy had been something I had been working on for a while, and I would spend, you know, weekends and nights, you know, after working long days, I'd come back and work on it, or I'd set aside days when I could with one of the co-writers, Jason Alvino. So even when I was working at the post-production company, I was developing the script and some of the other aspects of Itsy Bitsy. So
a true passion project.
I just decided to do that.
It's a true passion project, because when we talked to Elizabeth Roberts, she basically said the same thing, that this was a passion of yours for years.
Yeah.
And I'm a filmmaker myself. I did a short film. So I know sort of, you know, how you have to sort of keep your eye. You know, you have your life, but you always have this thing on the side. And to actually get it done, get it made as a feature,
huge.
And to get it released, and to get the buzz that it's gotten, that's impressive.
And to have it be good. I mean, there's nothing about this film, I think, that screams amateur at all. You know, it's like a solid professional, you know. It is a classic monster movie, which a lot of times doesn't get the respect, you know, but it's a great little film. Yeah, we loved it. And we were talking about, you know, you growing up around films and watching, going to the theater and watching the old VHS over and over and studying how films get made and all that. What are some films that inspired you? Have you always liked monster movies or genre type films? Or
I guess I've always liked, for the most part, I've always liked effects driven movies.
Oh.
There's something about effects that really fascinated me.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, and mainly, I mean, of the practical kind.
Right.
Even with visual effects, I prefer to do them in kind of an old school way, where you're mm-hmm. using actual elements whenever possible.
Right.
And any time that I let someone talk me out of it, which I got talked out of it a few times on Itsy Bitsy, I always feel it's a mistake, because I think you get something more tangible
right.
with those real elements. It just kind of has a different feel to it.
Yeah.
And so that was something that always fascinated me. I mean, you know, I wore out the old Star Wars VHS tapes to the point where they were like a song for me. It's like I knew every rhythm of the movie. And then when they came out with the special editions, it was different. Mm-hmm. Like it no longer had the same, it wasn't the same song anymore.
Right.
And so, but I watched all kinds of movies. But I, you know, I do have a love for those kind of like 80s Amblin movies. But then I also have a love for character dramas like The Godfather or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Was very revered in my household.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So Itsy Bitsy, you know, it was kind of like infused with both, which it's interesting because, you know, I know some filmmakers who Brett and Drew Pierce, they're the Pierce brothers. Mm-hmm. And we worked together back at a genre company. We were interns together and we kind of were working on the same concept at the same time. I was working with one of the brothers and then he ended up kind of doing something similar to what I was doing, which was that it was an Amblin movie feel set between two houses and it's a creature movie. But it's interesting because what you do with it can be totally different. And so, I mean, what they did with theirs, because I just saw the final cut of their film, is a lot more, I guess you could say, fun. It's a lot more Amblin. And it has a lot of like little twists in the scenes. Whereas with me at the time, I was so obsessed with making sure this film was taken seriously and that it also had good acting and kind of like an edge to it.
Right.
That I went a slightly different way. I mean, this is more like Cue the Winged Serpent or Of Unknown Origin, if you're familiar with there's kind of like a psychic link between the creature and the main character, so that the creature kind of has this relevance and it gives another dimension, hopefully, to the character drama.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I'm glad you guys dig it. I know that's not like as fun sometimes as like the classic Amblin approach. Oh, but I wanted it to have some of each, you know. Well, I wanted it to be taken seriously.
I think what you've done is more, you know, more of like what we were talking about the film earlier is like a Stephen King approach where he concentrates. I mean, people may not realize it as much because his set pieces are sort of overwhelm our memories of a lot of his films and books. But he is effortlessly excellent with characters. And I think he's so good with the characters that we sometimes forget how good he is with characters because they're so good. They're so believable. You just buy these people as real people.
Yeah.
And that is the most important. And as a writer, you know this, it's the most important element of any story.
Mm-hmm. We care about the characters. And there's some great scenes, you know, have nothing to do with the spider. A mom and his son and her son and that whole thing about responsibility, that scene in the hallway. There's just a lot of that you care about what happens to the family, and which has nothing to do with the spider. You know, of course, the spider is always there sort of lurking around, but it's the drama stands alone without the monster, you know, involved in the film. So when you put it together, when the spider starts doing its thing, it's doubly effective.
Yeah. You care about the people.
Great.
If you care about the people, then you're in the story.
Well, you wrote complex characters too, which I liked. I mean, they could have been easily just placeholders because people in peril, there's a spider, you know, how much work do you need to do? But you actually, you gave the main character a lot of complexity. And, you know, even like Bruce Davison, you know, you're still like not clear, like good guy, bad guy. Like you're still trying to, I like that you were never on sure footing, even with the main characters, which was a really nice little twist on that.
Yeah. And which was really challenging to do. It's like I couldn't have set a more difficult challenge for myself and the other writers and just the production team if I had tried. I mean, beyond the production challenges of having this puppet that's controlled by, you know, up to five different people that has to kind of like move in a certain way in a shot, plus visual effects, plus animals and kids.
Right.
And then on top of it, we have these like complex characters because I was told time and time again, like, look, you can't do this, you can't have this character who has these unlikable qualities,
right,
don't do it, it's a mistake. But somehow I kept coming back to it, and it just felt like that's what this story wanted to be. And so, yeah, I could have written a more fun, simple movie, and maybe for some people's taste, they would have preferred that. But somehow this movie kept coming back to that. And also at the time, when I was pitching it, you know, back in 2015 or early 2016, there was a lot of people who were, you know, the only creature reference at that time was like movies on the Sci-Fi Channel, like Sharknado and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And so they'd be like, oh yeah, like Sharknado. And I was like, no, nothing like Sharknado at all.
Not
and
candy.
So I may have pushed so hard to make it be taken seriously that, yeah, you know, I probably went farther in that direction than I would have if I hadn't have got that response, if people kind of understood what I was doing. Because I like fun movies, you know what I mean? I wouldn't mind making something that's more Amblin-y and more action-packed, but somehow this story evolved into, you know, being what it is.
Yeah.
So.
But there are scenes in this that are, you know, that are scary. I mean, and so to me, that's, you know, that to me is fun.
Yeah, and it almost isn't even action. Like we were talking about, one of our favorite scenes in the film is just the spider in the bathtub. It's not even doing anything, but we're like, oh my God. Like, to you me, were that was the most memorable.
You were channeling little Brian De Palma there with that overhead shot. You know, that's, and I, this is well documented on this podcast that I am not a fan of spiders, even little spiders, you know. So that scene, that overhead scene where the spider takes up the whole bottom of the clawfoot tub is like, oh my God. You know,
so
that
creepy.
Was just,
yeah.
that just got to me. So,
well, it plays into those primal fears. I mean, how many times have you opened, you know, you're going to take a shower and you open the shower curtain and there's a, you know, a spider in there?
I'd say no.
Never. Happens to me every time I take a shower. Why?
So why?
Yeah, well, and that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to sort of like hit those touchstones, those things that really kind of resonate with people because they have actual experiences with spiders, and also, you know, hit those places where you feel vulnerable. You know, because
yeah,
even if it wasn't a spider, you might check under the bed or worry about what's in the bathtub. Or,
well,
you
one
know,
of the things.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. What were you saying?
No, you're talking about vulnerable, and one of my favorite scenes in the film doesn't even have the spider in it. It's the one where the little girl goes up to the attic, and that was for me a really suspenseful scene because you know this is a tiny little girl up in the attic, and we talked with Elizabeth about that too, and she was like, "Oh, I know," and it's like. The shot of her little foot on the step, you know, and you're thinking that to me was so suspenseful, you know, a little tiny girl up there. And she doesn't know there's all, you know, there's, I think there was the eggs up there and the spider webs and stuff. And it was just, you know, the idea of a little girl in the attic is creepy.
Yeah. On
enough.
A ladder.
Yeah. And climbing down the ladder and her little foot is slipping, you know, it was just, it was like, that's pretty intense.
Just suspense all the time. So
yeah.
why a spider? What made you decide to do a spider monster movie?
I've always been fascinated by spiders. And when I was a kid, I would pray at night that spiders wouldn't come and bite my toes.
I feel your pain.
I don't know.
This is Mark, and I feel your pain.
Yeah. So somehow that was just a thing for me. And spiders always were something I was afraid of, but also became fascinated by, and especially as I started looking at them. I started looking at them with a magnifying glass, and it made me realize, oh, you know what, we need to size this up a little bit.
Right.
Just enough that you can see those details that feel like a creature from outer space, but not so much that it's a kaiju. You know, I didn't want to make like a kaiju movie where it's just a lumbering beast. I still wanted it to have the same behavioral patterns as a spider. And so that as much as possible, you're getting those real sort of National Geographic feeling moments. It's just heightened.
Yeah.
You know, we just kind of amp it up a little bit.
Well, it wasn't a Burt I. Gordon enlargement. It's the kind of thing where when I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, there could, when you think about prehistoric times, everything was bigger. You know, there could have been spiders right. that big running around. It's not outrageous enlargement, because when you get above a certain point, there's like a realism range of enlargements mm-hmm. of animals, and when you get past. Any bigger than what you had would have been like a little bit much, you know, like
right.
maybe less yeah. scary, less creepy, and more just like you were saying, this lumbering giant that you're afraid it's going to tear the house down. But this one, you're afraid that it's going to touch you.
Because it can mm-hmm. still be hidden. It yes. can still hide. It's big enough to hide in
exactly.
corners
so,
and that kind
exactly.
of stuff.
So it can still hide. And you know, another thing that's always creeped me out about spiders is there's been a couple where I thought I had them, or they were there one moment yeah. and then they were gone.
Right.
And so stuff like that is something you can do with yeah, a smaller size. And also that reclusive behavior that denotes a certain intelligence, I think works really well with, you know, being able to hide and,
yeah.
and mm-hmm. it making a choice as to when it wants to be seen and when it's going to make its move.
Well, it's very
stuff like that.
It's very realistic. I mean, not only in the way it looked, but it really felt like it had weight, because it probably did. You know, it's a practical
yeah.
effect. Did you were you a fan like Rob Bottin from like The Thing? Was that kind of the style you were kind of, because that's like the touchstone, the gold
Rob
standard.
Rob Bottin is, you know, I mean his work in the, I mean all of his work.
Yeah.
But I mean his work in the Thing and Total Recall and Ridley Scott's Legend, there's something about his work that has a really surreal quality.
It all goes back to the sculpture, the ability of it. It's like with Dick Smith's work, it's even mm-hmm. the work he did a long time ago for television, his ability at sculpting
yeah.
is what really sells it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And not just sculpt it, but the way that they perform, you mm-hmm. know, like you mentioned Dick Smith, and that leads to all these guys. I mean, like yeah. Stan Winston,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Tom Savini. It's like those guys are like, they're artists. And I know that, you know, Stan Winston was working with like bigger and bigger teams.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, you know, there's this thing nowadays where some of the effects are really well done, but there's a little bit of that, like, artistry quality that's lost, not
yeah.
in terms of like yeah. the technique is phenomenal, but the actual you don't feel the artist behind it sometimes
right.
the
yeah.
way that you used to.
Yeah,
that's why Ray Harryhausen's stuff still works, is it's the mm-hmm. You know, you look at it now with our sophisticated CGI eyes, and his work is obviously a special effect. It's like when the Cyclops steps in, you are looking at a special effect. But the characterization is there, the posture, the movement, the weight, the behavior, the personality. That is an element. It has
yeah.
to be an element.
Yeah.
Or the thing just looks like an animated corpse, a dead
yeah.
thing that's moving.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's what's so beautiful about Dan Rebert's work in this film, because, you know, look, we were working with a very low budget. I don't think that what we accomplished wasn't exactly what Dan and I were hoping and dreaming of. And yet it's sort of like, you know, you shoot for the moon and hit the stars. I still feel like we got to a good place.
Yeah.
Obviously if we had more money, we could have got to an even better place, because putting
yeah.
this stuff in perspective, it's like these movies, like it's really interesting talking to, you know, executives in the business and sales agents and stuff like that, because they have certain ideas of, oh, you got to hit this
right.
budget.
Yeah.
And I understand it. And yet all these movies that everyone aspires to and loves, like, weren't made for anywhere near that budget.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They were all made for more.
Yeah.
yeah right.
And so that was an interesting challenge. But what was great about Dan is that he has such a sense of performance. And so we were able to take this creature that I had already developed and then rework it so that it performed even better, because you can have this beautiful thing. And I see it all the time on Instagram. You can see things that look really great in a still photo, and yet it just doesn't perform the way that it needs to
exactly.
in an actual
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
And so that's what was great about Dan, is he is that old school artist type of guy in his heart.
Yeah.
And has a good sense of both the craft of doing the effect, but also the character. So we would have long discussions about the character and what we wanted it to do, and also how would it behave. And yeah. if I had a question about that, Dan and I talked about it the same way that I would talk with an actor about a scene.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because you are kind of directing the spider, essentially, talking to someone like that.
It's about puppeteering a lot of times with practical effects. And there's certain effects that I'm always amazed by when I go back and look at them again. And I've gotten to the point where I don't even see them as special effects anymore. But then when I stop and think, okay, like one example, I know it's a common example, but Yoda.
Yeah.
Yoda is a rubber puppet. Period. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. But Yoda is more the person's hand in there, the performance, the movement, mm-hmm. the subtleties, the nuances, the character of Yoda. There's a way that he moved, a way his eyes would turn before his head would turn, and all these little subtle things that happen in living creatures that, you know, Frank Oz understands, having been a puppeteer his whole life. And
right.
Those are things that if a person not as skilled in those things, in those subtleties, in those subtle nuances, had done Yoda, it would have looked ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also just think this is the standard thing, but for a practical effect versus a CGI effect, is that, you know, the actor is there working with this tangible thing. So if you have this, this puppet spider, you know, 6 inches away from your face, you know it's fake. You know there's people around, but it's still going to be ooky. It's still going to be weird, as opposed to nothing. You know,
like a tennis ball on a stick.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. No. And I fully believe that. You know, not just for the actors, but the audience does that too. You know, I've had discussions with friends where they criticize the dragons in Game of Thrones. And I'm like, look, I've seen every dragon movie ever made. Yeah. They're some of the best dragons I've ever seen.
Exactly.
But yeah.
There's a human instinct, I think, where you're looking at something that you know doesn't exist and you're picking it apart.
Right.
It's like it's the just fake kind job of like of a Hutt. Natural part of the human brain, I think.
Well, it's like the fake Jabba the Hutt, you know, when that was brought in, you go, okay, you know, a 4-year-old can go, that's not.
It's not the same as the one in the throne room. You know, that one was real.
Like a cartoon.
Yeah.
So it's like that's what I figured is look, CG is an incredible technology.
Yeah.
You're still basically making like a very high tech cartoon. And so I felt like, look, if we start with something practical, then we do everything we can practically in the most old school way possible first.
Yeah.
And then if we can't do it, then we, you know, go to CG, or we go to CG for this element of it that we couldn't do on set on the day. Or if we do this, then that'll kind of bring it even more to life in the frame. And so that was how we approached effects, was a lot more along the lines of that old school methodology, which I think some of the best examples were like T2 and Jurassic Park, when they were still nervous about the CG technology.
Yeah.
So because they were nervous about it, they did everything practically they could.
Yeah.
Right.
And Jurassic Park was almost a stop motion by Phil Tippett. You know, that was it was almost an old school movie, but then it became the primary example of the best CG at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
But the practical, you know, the scene with the brontosaurus, I think, right, where it was the practical head. That was such a realistic scene. And it was done with practical effects.
The most memorable shots, the foot, the T-Rex foot going into the mud, you know, those things, those Stan Winston full-size props.
So how much rehearsal time goes into a scene that involves a puppet-like spider like that? Because I would assume getting the choreography just right and just repeating it over and over would be really difficult, coming out the exact same way every
time.
Like
a dance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely like a dance. It's like a dance with five people.
Yeah.
And
a spider.
Especially on an indie movie like this, there's never enough time. There's never enough time. There's never enough money. It really is like one of those things that you have to be like a little half crazy to even do. Because, it was definitely going into the initial shoot, we had almost no rehearsal time. Like I wanted to kind of do what you should do on these movies where you practice everything, you have it 100% correct, you know exactly what your shots are before you even get into it. And unfortunately, you know, there's so many other things going on leading up to the original location shoot that, you know, everything's coming together at the last possible second, and you're just hoping everyone's going to show up on the day.
Right.
And yeah, so we really didn't have the time that we needed. When we did some of our stage work, you know, I call it a stage, it was really a warehouse, but when we did kind of our stage work and pickups, we did have a little more time, which was good, because it did allow us to, you know, I'd go in and mess around with the DSLR. We had storyboarded and planned everything to the point where, you know, my shot lists knew what was an effect shot, how many puppeteers were required, you know, was there a special lighting or camera rig required? Was there lightning or not? You know, and if so, like, it gets down to the kind of level of detail where you have the grip, like, pressing buttons on a little box and saying, is the lightning like this?
Right.
He presses it twice. Or is it more like this? And he presses it three times. Right. And where do you want it to hit? Do you want it to hit after this moment or on this moment? Wow. So, you know, you're making those kind of minute decisions plus the complication of creature effects. And then, yeah, the hardest thing is the rhythm. So the most difficult thing was the shots where you see it walk. That requires five puppeteers, and they all have to do it in unison. And most of the time we didn't have five puppeteers. So usually it's like three puppeteers and then two PAs that were pulling in from somewhere else.
Right.
You know what I mean? Who have no idea what they're doing, and you're trying to kind of get it into a rhythm, and you're trying to set a tone where it feels like it's actually walking. And literally one leg being off.
Yeah.
Ruins it.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
And so it was it took kind of like you have this kind of zen like focus where you're just praying internally that somehow it's going to work out.
Yeah.
And it's like directing anything else. It's like you don't want to say too much because you can get in people's heads and start to confuse them, and then they kind of never come back from that.
Yeah.
But when something needs to be fixed, you got to tell them how to fix it.
And then you've got somebody saying, does she already have the dirt smudge on her shoulder in scene 27, or does that happen later?
Right.
It's, yeah. You're juggling a thousand cats when you're directing a film like this, and it's it's a...
How did your head not explode?
Yeah.
Just even that explanation would be like, oh my God.
I heard that, I'm like, I'll never make a movie. I can't handle it. It's too much.
But you know what's funny is when you're in there and it's on and it's happening, you know, I'm sure you experienced this with your film, is
in the zone.
It's so much fun in a weird, scary way.
Was it
fun? No, it's literally one of my favorite things is working on those kinds of effects challenges. It's kind of like a puzzle for my mind that I really like, and I like coming up with different techniques and how we're going to do this one different than that one, because I feel like that too somehow, and I don't know exactly why, but I feel like that helps the suspension of disbelief, the fact that you're not doing the effect the same way shot to shot. It's not all CG, and then I try to come up with these kind of surprising tidbits where I can, where it's sort of like, how did they do that? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
And
then once the
mind goes to how did they do that, then I think you're on a better track of people kind of letting go and not trying to figure out how you did everything. And they just kind of go with the character a little more.
Well, that totally works here. I mean, I didn't, and also the fact that you know, less is more in these kind of movies. Like you don't give away too much of the creature until, you know, halfway through the film or even a little bit later, and you just show enough every single time, you know, and I won't spoil the scenes, but we know what they are.
Yeah.
And it's just enough to go, man, it works. Like there's not one scene in the movie where you don't feel like that's a real thing.
Yeah. And just so, knowing where to, in the context of the story, knowing where to point the camera and what to film, you know,
sounds like you have a friend.
Do you have a spider back there? That's a bird.
You have a parrot?
Yeah, it's a bird. Oh, it's a bird out here.
So it's a little bit of a left turn, but I really like the movie posters for Itsy Bitsy. I like that they're sort of fairy tale almost looking. I do movie posters for a living. So
cool.
When I see a poster like this, they're both illustrated, which is super rare in the industry. And they aren't necessarily showing specifically, you know, a certain actor in it. How do you, did you have any say over any of the marketing materials like that? Or is that just out of your control?
I had say over the original poster. So the original poster of the girl in the bed, which was done by Matthew Peake. That was a collaboration between Matthew Peake and I. And I had total say over that because he came up with, you know, three or four other concepts and we talked about them and we talked about which was the right approach and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so I was very pleased with that poster. The distributor felt, Shout Factory felt that, you know, we needed to kind of amp it up, especially for their audience, and they wanted to see more spider. And right. So they essentially came up with the other concept. And I didn't have any say in it. Essentially it was done, but you know, what was good about it was, you know, I was kind of talking with them and I was able to get Matthew Peake to do that one as well. Which he did partly just as a favor because he really likes the project and he's like, look, I want to see this through and I want these things to have continuity. And so he did that one, which I thought what was kind of cool about it was, you know, A, I think the spider looks really cool on it.
Yeah.
And B, it kind of looked like an old book cover to me. It looked like an old kind of horror pulp novel.
Yeah.
And frankly, if it was up to me, I would have leaned farther in that direction. I would have kind of made it look like an old ragged, you know, had a little like torn edges or something to it so that it looks like what you're kind of leaning into, especially since the character on it like isn't in the film.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that kind of might be a surprise for some people, but as far as it being like exciting and being in line with the title, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I'm glad that both of them were done by Matthew Peake. And I'm also really glad that, you know, they aren't like these kind of bobblehead sales company posters. You know what I mean? They're both conceptual. And they're just kind of two different conceptual ideas on the same film. And so from that standpoint, I'm pretty pleased with both of them. I think there's a little bit of a backlash that some people experience. And I don't think it's just from the poster, although the kind of newer poster kind of feels almost like you might be expecting a spider slasher movie or something that's a little racier in a way than what the movie is, because we don't have any like half naked women in negligees or anything like in the film, really. You know, it's always this thing with like, how do you sell a movie? You have to kind of make it exciting, and maybe it's my fault. Maybe it's sort of like with the title Itsy Bitsy, someone has expectations that maybe are potentially a little pulpier than the film that I delivered, which is more serious and character driven. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things that you kind of hope people settle into and that they enjoy, but it's, you know.
Yeah, the marketing end of the business is it's pretty intense. You want to please the filmmakers, but a lot of times you're trying to please the studios, which just want to make the most money possible. So you're trying to appeal to the broadest audience possible. And a lot of times I feel like there's some dishonesty in that sometimes, like when I've done posters and they'll say, don't make it look too horror or sci-fi. I'm like, but it's a sci-fi movie. What do you want? Uh-huh. So you get that a lot. But I mean, and if people don't know, Matthew Peake did the original Nightmare on Elm Street poster. He's illustrator. Kidding. Yeah. Oh, wow. He's kind of a legend.
The claw coming down.
Oh, he's absolutely a legend. And his dad is also a legend.
Okay.
And did the posters for
like Apocalypse Now and stuff, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah. Apocalypse
Major
Now,
stuff.
The first Star Trek movie, and so many other like classic movies. And so it's sort of a family gift, you know, family business. But what I loved so much about Matthew's work from Nightmare on Elm Street is how surreal it is.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of surrealness really works with our concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, you know, I think that I hope people like both the artwork, because I think both versions of the artwork are very strong. And like, yeah. I say, you know, it's like the fact that Shout wanted this, wanted more with the spider, and that it is more exciting. It, like I say, in a way, their poster probably delivers more on the title than maybe my movie does, which is, you know, it's sort of, I don't know what to say about that. You know, it kind of is what it is. And it's one of those things too, where when you're making a low budget movie, you know, for people who are like, why isn't there spider action nonstop? Well, I just would have had to have about 5 or 6 times the amount of money that I had.
Exactly. Yeah.
In order to do that at the level that we did it at. So it's like, if anyone has any issues with the effects, it's like, if I had done more effects, the quality would have dropped down. It wouldn't right. have gone up.
Well, I think with the posters and with the film that you delivered, I know, you know, it was a low budget film. I don't know what the budget was, but it doesn't feel like a low budget movie to me.
And
everything about it seems like you squeezed every penny that you could out of it, and it shows. I mean, I've seen movies that I know were bigger budgets than this that mm-hmm. don't look as good or as yeah. professionally shot or as, you know, well acted. So, you know, you got a great cast, Denise Crosby. I mean, the kids were great.
Yeah.
They were really good actors. So
yeah, you had some good A-list people in your first movie. That's an accomplishment all on its own.
Yeah, the acting, we were really lucky. And early on, I had met Eileen Dietz, who played Pazuzu in The Exorcist. And she also did some... you know, she did some stunt work for the young girl and stuff like that.
Yeah, she goes way back.
And
she's
so
great.
Yeah, she's great. And she read the script and just really loved the script and was willing to be a supporter of me and be a supporter of the screenplay. And frankly, it was because of her that we got Bruce, because they have the same manager, Chris Rowe. And, you know, Bruce gets scripts all the time. So Chris Rowe gets scripts all the time, not just for Bruce, but all of his clients. And I'm pretty convinced probably never would have even read it if it weren't for the fact that Eileen took a stand and said, listen, I babysit your kids on the weekends, you're going to read this. and he read it, and they got back to me, and we were able to get Bruce. And so even though sales companies kind of have whatever calculations they have, and I don't think it really like ticked the needle in any of those categories, it still was a huge thing to me, because I knew that he's a great actor. He's going to be fantastic in the part.
Yeah.
And other actors know that. So other actors, you know, are excited to work with Academy Award nominee Bruce Davison mm-hmm. on a movie. Oh, yeah. And so it upped everyone's game. And it got more interesting people involved. And it and also on set, it was the same thing. You know, he was very interested in kind of talking about every line and talking about his character. And so it improved his character, but him being there and him being that serious about the material, you know, the fact that he came out to our location shoot and was fully prepared, like as if it was any other movie, and took the part as seriously as any other movie, made everyone else step up to that level.
Oh, that's cool.
And so, we were very lucky to have him. And it's the same thing with Denise. I mean, Denise was fantastic. Really, really a good spirit and easygoing, considering, you know, all the challenges that a low budget movie has. I mean, her first night we're there, you know, we're up at like 4 a.m. or something like that. And other people are freaking out, but Denise is not. Denise was very calm and friendly and, you know, just brought a really great energy to the set and really kind of had a special connection, I think, to her part. And brought something totally unique and plausible to that character. So I'm just really grateful to both of them and all the other actors, and, you know, for what they did. It accomplished what I wanted, which was to have it be a serious character drama too, not just kind of a goofy spider movie.
Right.
So. Was it intimidating to sort of direct those particular actors, or you know, was that like not a problem? It was just like the set was very sort of comfortable for you and for everybody, and
Was it? You know, I didn't even have time to be intimidated. It was there was so much to do that it was really just kind of like we just had to get right to work. But yeah, the challenges on set had nothing to do with them. There were a lot of challenges on the original location shoot. It was extremely difficult. We were having a lot of kind of behind the scenes issues that were, you know, cutting into our days in ways that I had never experienced before on my other projects and stuff like that, which ultimately we sorted out by the end, and also sorted out on anything subsequent that we did. But those were the challenges, was just kind of being on a low budget location indie shoot where a lot of the people you're working with, you've never met before.
Right.
And you've kind of gotten whoever you could get there. You know what I mean?
And trying to keep that schedule, which is probably tight as it is. And then you start start getting behind and this, where'd you shoot it?
Well, we shot the majority of it up here. So our first location shoot was up here in Merced, California.
Gotcha.
And so we kind of did a mix. I'd say it was mostly up here in the Central Valley that we shot the majority of the movie. But, you know, like the warehouse shoot that we did was out in Monrovia. And then we had a few pickups out in Santa Clarita. So some of it was also in the L.A. area for here, so to speak. Mm. But this was where the majority of the film was made, was up here in the center of the state.
And it took how long was the shoot? Was it sort of, you know, fits and starts over a course of, you know, a longer period of time?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we had our initial 16-day shoot, which was supposed to be 15 days. And we would have got a lot more done if it weren't for the fact that we had those production problems. I mean, to put it in perspective, it's like I get somewhere between, like, let's say 25 to 35 setups a day is normally what I'm accustomed to getting on a film set.
Right.
And I think the first day we maybe got 6 setups the whole day.
So you're behind the
and then we got though. Like 8 the next day, and I'm like, oh man, this is not going well. And luckily, like I was able to kind of like stay focused and make sure that what we were getting was kind of what we needed to get. But you just don't have room for that kind of margin of error on an indie movie.
Right.
You know, you can't like lose days. And so because of that, you know, we came back for our, I think it was a 7 or 8 day shoot in our warehouse. Mm-hmm. And so we always planned to do that because we wanted more control over the majority of the creature stuff and the ability to, you know, you have to have special considerations for puppet work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so we had some built sets and walls and things to kind of do some of those gags. But then we had some pickups after that. And really, I don't think we would have had to have the pickups after that if it weren't for the fact that, you know, we ran into those problems early on. But it's also what was nice about that structure was that it allowed us to edit the movie with storyboards cut in, or with little test shots that we did on our iPhone or on a DSLR cut in. And so it gave us time to kind of look at it and say, okay, what do we really need?
Right.
Do we really need everything we were planning, or do we just need this or that? And so it worked out in the end, but that was essentially what it was. So.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on it. I think it's great. What's upcoming for you? What's anything in the hopper or anything come up for you, director-wise or writing?
Yeah, you know, I don't know yet. I have a TV pilot that I wrote with one of my co-writers with Brian Dick. And so that TV pilot is getting shopped around, and I know there's interest. It's a totally different genre. Yeah. It's like a police story. Based on some true events, like there was a guy who I met and he has a manuscript, and I spent some time with him doing research and talking to some of his comrades from back in the day. And so we're both very excited about that one. And that's kind of getting shopped around now. That's a TV pilot script. And then I have some other things I'm working on, but what I'd really like to do is, you know, find the right partnership with a production company or with a, distributor or sales company or producer or someone, just so that I'm working on something that has someone involved besides me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
That is the key. It's like, you know, like with anybody trying to break in, it's like find that partner so you have somebody else motivating you and also some business propositions, you know, that are waiting in the wings. So it's, hey, we can do this and this will eventually be streaming somewhere or, you know, go to festivals or whatever it is, you know. So
Right. It's
good not to have to do everything by yourself.
Also, too, if they tell me, hey, you know, I'm interested in this or I've got a couple good scripts and here's one of them if you want to check it out, then it's sort of, because there's a lot of different things that I can do just depending on, you know, what they want to do. And so, you know, what I'd rather not do, I'll continue to develop my own stuff, but I don't want to spend, you know, 2 years writing one thing and then I come back and they're like, oh no, that's not what we want.
No, I got you. Totally. Well, you have a great calling card because it's a wonderful film and people should see it if they haven't. And you can see it everywhere, right? Streaming wise, or is it on Amazon?
Yeah. It's on VOD. And it's done really well. You know, it was like in the top 10 on iTunes opening weekend when it came out and stayed in the top 20 with, you know, very little to no marketing. Wow. It was like top 3 or 4 in its category on Amazon by like week 3. And then it's done. The Blu-ray was released October 1st and it's done, you know, really good business. Like, you know, Shout was telling me that it was really great, you know, selling out of Walmart and I had some friends who were going to Best Buy where it was selling out. So it's been doing really well on Blu-ray as well.
People want to see a good, scary creature feature movie, especially around Halloween.
Yeah.
I'm just in the Halloween mood for it. It definitely stands
out. What's good about it is that even though, you know, Shout has released it not rated, but it's not, you know from seeing it, it's not like it's like X-rated. In fact, it has like no curse words, no nudity, you know, very little. There's no like blood or guts type stuff. It's mainly thrills and suspense. So it's something that the whole family can enjoy on Halloween, I think. So
It's a classic Halloween movie. You know, everybody's got those big spiders in their front yard and, you know,
that's
spider
true.
Webs.
It comes to life.
What is your dream project in the future, like a future job that you would love to have as far as directing?
I mean, I love doing effects driven movies. And so I would love to do a sequel to Itsy Bitsy that is more action packed. There's a lot of things that, even ideas that Dan Reber and I had that like we just couldn't do because we didn't have the funding or time to do it. So I definitely would know how to amp that up to a whole nother level and show some things that people have never seen before there. And then I'd also like to do something in the sci-fi realm. I have some ideas on how I could do something that's pretty low budget. And I have some of the ideas of the world and the basic concept, but I don't have a script for that. But I would just love to do something in that genre, you know, something where I'm playing with effects, but in kind of more that world building type of a way.
Yeah.
Even if it's on a smaller scale.
Right.
Yeah. We'll keep our eyes open for that.
Yes. And you're always welcome back whenever. If you just want to talk movies in general and stuff, that's what we're all about.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. And I'm happy to come back as well. If there's ever any reason why you want me back on to talk, happy to do that.
Well, give us a reason. Keep making movies.
Yeah, this is on
I'll
you.
I'll try. Yeah, I'll work on that.
And if you're ever down in LA, you know, this is where we do, you know, this is where Cinemondo Industries is set up.
Yeah.
So
cool. Yeah.
Thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah. Thanks for,
thank you.
Thanks for being on. It was fun to talk to you. This is like a crash course in how to get your film made.
Very inspiring.
Yeah, we're big on talking about indie film because it's so, you know, it's a labor of love, it's a passion, and I know how hard it is to make a short because that's what I did, to make a feature and do it in, you know, whatever, 16 days fits and starts over, you know, a long period of time is, you know, it's to just do it is quite an accomplishment, and then the finished project is as good as it is, you know, it's kudos to you and the whole crew.
Yeah, we all work in the entertainment industry, so we know we understand what it takes to complete a project.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, it's really a great pleasure to talk with people that are so passionate and knowledgeable about genre movies and about movies in general. And so, Yeah, if you ever come across a script that you want me to read, I'd be happy to read that too.
Oh, we'll write some.
I'll send you 24. Yeah, you're opening up in 5 minutes.
Oh my God!
You're opening up Pandora's box, yeah. Micah. You might not want to go that
please
route.
Please cut that.
Yeah.
That thing I said about other scripts don't.
Suddenly your email is going ding 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 ding.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
All right, so yeah, everybody out there listening, Itsy Bitsy, catch it on Blu-ray or DVD or on VOD. It's well worth your time. A perfect Halloween flick. Yep.
Yeah, and it was really fun talking to you.
Thanks,
Micah.
Thanks
take
so
care
much.
Now.
Take care.
Alrighty.
Bye.
We'll see ya. This is Cinemondo signing off.